Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Battle 241. It is November 8th. I missed Halloween. Okay, so November 8th, and we're going to have a lecture on blood today, at least certain parts of blood. There's a lot in this chapter that I'm not going to cover because you should already know it from anatomy, like the anatomy of the heart, right? But we're going to go over physiology and maybe even some structure of blood vessels you guys should know already. All right, so let's see what's on our list. Overview. Here is, let me make sure I don't miss a slide. Overview, that's good. Okay, functions of the circulatory system. All right, so it transports oxygen, nutrients, enzymes and hormones throughout your body, right? So once something's in the blood, it goes everywhere that blood goes. And blood doesn't go to every place in your body. For instance, like the middle ear, you don't have really much of a vascular supply in the middle ear. So that can be problematic sometimes. Maybe you have an infection of the middle ear. Well, it's hard to get antibiotics into that area because blood isn't carrying anything into that part of your body. Right, it can also transport carbon dioxide, and you should know something about carbon dioxide. That's a byproduct of respiration, right? So that's an excretory product, and other kinds of waste products away from tissues outside of your body. How do you get rid of carbon dioxide from your body? Yeah, you just exhale it out through your breathing. All right, but here's another important point you probably haven't considered, and that's the transport of heat within your body to maintain body temperature. So heat transfer is very important. So you might have a heavily metabolic organ, maybe a muscle that's producing a lot of heat. Well, the blood can pick up that heat, deliver it to your skin, and then your skin can radiate it off. Or maybe your skin will start to sweat, and then that evaporation process will decrease your body temperature back down to normal. Blood also maintains fluid, electrolyte, and pH balance in your body. It has buffers in it. And it protects your body from disease-causing microorganisms. There are certain cells that fight infections, and there are other certain kinds of molecules called antibodies that fight infections and other kinds of foreign substances, maybe even toxins. And they're also responsible for getting rid of tumors, abnormal growths in your body. And another real important function that we're going to spend a lot of time on is just to prevent blood loss. Because what kind of tissue is blood? Let's just review. What kind of tissue is blood? Yeah, it's a connective tissue. But what kind of connective tissue is it? Kind of strange connective tissue. It's not hard like bone. Okay? What kind of connective tissue is blood? It's a fluid connective tissue, right? So it can flow from one part of your body to the other. And if you damage a blood vessel, then that connective tissue can even flow right out of your body. Right? So preventing blood loss when blood vessels get damaged are very important. What happens if I do that? Nothing good. All right. Move back down over here. All right, so components of the circulatory system, there are two main components, the cardiovascular system, which makes up blood vessels, right, and the lymphatic system. All right, cardiovascular system, let's just kind of run through some of these things. What makes up the cardiovascular system? Okay, your heart, yeah, your myocardium, and blood vessels, and give me at least three kinds of blood vessels. And maybe some definitions, just to make sure we're all on the same page. We have arteries. What does an artery do? Takes blood away from the heart. Okay, so we got arteries. What's another kind? A vein. What does a vein do? Yeah, it brings blood toward the heart. And then what's the third kind? Capillaries. What's special about capillaries? Is there anything special about it? Oh, okay, exchange takes place in capillaries. So that's the only way that things can enter or leave the cardiovascular system, and that is through a capillary. But of course, don't forget about arterioles and venules. We'll talk about those too, but those are just some subspecializations of arteries. Lymphatic system picks up excess fluid in tissue spaces so that when you have blood flowing through a capillary, there is a significant amount of fluid volume leaving the capillary at the proximal end, and most of it is resorbed on the distal end, but not all of that fluid. And that fluid then remains in your tissue spaces and we would actually start to swell up if it were not for the lymphatic system that collects that excess fluid in that extracellular space and returns it back to the heart. So a lymphatic system, at least these lymphatic vessels, kind of act like special little veins to drain a lot of tissue fluid back toward the heart, so where it re-enters the cardiovascular system. All right, and also, as that lymph is flowing back to your cardiovascular system, it flows through a lymph node, and the lymph nodes filter that lymph and remove infectious particles from lymph so you don't get an infection in your body. Okay, so it's an important part of the immune system as well. So it fights infections. Next slide. All right, blood. Composition of blood. You have about 5 liters of blood in your body. It's composed of two compartments. You have plasma, which is the first compartment, and the second compartment is formed elements. Formed elements are cells or cell fragments. These are particles that are surrounded by cell membranes, and they have cytoplasm. Some have nuclei, some don't. All right, so anything else that's in your blood is what we call plasma. That's the fluid part of blood. All right, so you got the fluid part and the cellular part, but just remember that the fluid part is called plasma, and the cellular part is what we call formed elements. Most of plasma is water, over 92%. And then various things dissolve in that fluid, like some kinds of proteins. And then you have nutrients. What's your favorite nutrient that dissolves in plasma easily? Sugar, like glucose. That's what I would expect maybe somebody to say, glucose. All right, ions. Do you have a favorite ion? Maybe somebody would say sodium or potassium, but probably you're being swayed a little bit now by calcium, because that's a very important ion in your body. Some gases dissolve in plasma. Okay, oxygen doesn't do a really good job of dissolving in plasma, but some gases do, like CO2, and waste products. And then so these are all just transported in the fluid part of blood. And in terms of these proteins, you should know that there are three major classes of proteins that are in blood. Right, there are globulins that fight infection, and globulins also transport hydrophobic compounds, because hydrophobic compounds don't like to dissolve in plasma, right? Because they're lipophilic. And clotting factors, these are proteins that prevent blood loss. They form blood clots when a blood vessel is damaged. And then the third one right here, albumin. Everybody kind of forgets about this one, but albumin is made by the liver, and it is just a particle that's in blood, right? So if you have a lot of albumin in one part of a solution and very little albumin maybe on the other side of this solution, maybe across a cell membrane, which way is water going to go? It's going to go from a place where there is low albumin to a place where there is high albumin, right? So water is going to go down its concentration gradient. So albumin in your body is used to draw water into capillaries, into other vessels. So it will help draw water from tissue spaces into a blood vessel where it belongs. So somebody with liver damage, maybe liver cancer, is not producing these albumins. What's going to be the effect of being low albumins in your body? You're going to swell up, and that swelling condition is what we call edema as a result of that. Okay, in terms of these formed up, oh no, there's one last thing I got to talk about. You've heard of serum before, and if we take plasma, which contains all of these different substances, including these proteins, and then take clotting factors out of plasma, right, then we call that a serum. So plasma minus clotting factors is still serum. So if somebody needs electrolytes, right, and maybe if somebody needs some kind of globulins to fight an infection, then we would call that a serum. And sometimes it's called anti-serum because maybe this serum was derived or received from an animal that has built antibodies against a certain kind of venom. And then that serum is injected into people, is loaded with antibodies that destroys that venom. And if that's the case, then we just don't call that a serum. We call that an anti-serum because it's actually fighting a specific toxic molecule in your body. All right, in terms of formed elements, you got white blood cells, And you got red blood cells, and you have platelets. Those are the three main categories. Red blood cells, sometimes we call these erythrocytes, and erythro just means red. These are anucleate. They don't have a nucleus. They're still a living cell, but they don't live for a very long period of time because they cannot rebuild any kind of damaged parts that they have. So they only live for about 120 days, and then they die. White blood cells do have a nucleus, and some of them have a very complicated nucleus. Some white blood cells, the whole cell almost fills up with just that one nucleus, right? So we're going to look at some of those white blood cells, and another name for a white blood cell is a leukocyte. Guess what leuko means? It means white, yeah. And then the last kind right here, a thrombocyte, that's a platelet. These are anucleate cell fragments. They're very, very small. And these are important for preventing blood loss. So when a blood vessel is damaged, these platelets will seal over that site of injury and prevent blood from leaving that blood vessel. Okay, so here we have a test tube. And we've gotten some whole blood. So we've just maybe placed a needle in somebody's vein and aspirated out a whole bunch of blood. Okay, so it's got all those components that we talked about. It's got the formed elements, all the formed elements, and it's got plasma. And we want to look at, in particular, what volume is made up of red blood cells. And when we make that measurement, we call that the hematocrit. So the hematocrit is just the percentage of red blood cells out of a sample of whole blood, which contains everything. And if we were to look at this test tube right here, can you guess about how much of this total volume is just made up of red blood cells, just by looking at it? Yeah, it's kind of close to 50%, but not quite, right? So 40-something would be a good guess. So hematocrit will be in about that range. For males, it's a little bit higher. The normal range is 41 to 53%. For women, it's a little bit less, 36 to 46% in women. And the way that we get that is from a whole blood sample. We could just set that test tube on the countertop and wait overnight, right, and then come back in the morning and read what the volume is. And if you just have a ruler, that's pretty good as long as the size of the container is uniform from top to bottom. But what's a faster way of determining a hematocrit? Get a whole blood sample, put it in a test tube and centrifuge it, spin it so that all the heavy stuff falls to the bottom. Red blood cells are the heaviest, and then you can actually determine a hematocrit in just a couple of minutes, so it's easy to do. So the layers that I see in this test tube now are formed elements from here to here. Something that makes formed elements are what? Red blood cells and white blood cells. And there are some platelets in here as well, but they're such a small volume that they really don't count. This very thin layer we call the buffy coat, that's made up of white blood cells and platelets. And you can see that in a spun test tube, right? And then all the fluid part is up on top. So that's just a centrifuge blood sample. All right, so here we see just kind of a nice micrograph of some red blood cells. And you see that a red blood cell is a concave, it's a biconcave cell. Yeah, it's probably red, huh? Okay, I ran out of batteries with this thing. It's just a biconcave cell, and the shape of this cell means that it has a very high surface area to volume ratio. So it has a very high surface area. What did we say about surface area? What good is surface area? Surface area is important for exchange, for moving, okay, across the cell membrane. And so the job of a red blood cell here is to transport oxygen. So oxygen should diffuse in and out of the cell, and the way that it gets in and out of the cell is through the cell membrane. So the shape of this thing just maximizes, right, the surface area or the area of the cell membrane for diffusion of gases. And then I see some white blood cells here that fight infection. And then I even see some little cell fragments that are platelets that prevent blood loss. All right, so here is just a little question that you should answer for yourself sometime. Okay, if you have an 80 ml sample of whole blood from a normal individual, right, if it contains 30 mLs of erythrocytes and 0.72 mLs of leukocytes and 4 mLs of thrombocytes after centrifuging, is the sample from a man or a woman? Okay, so you should be able to calculate that, maybe just in a minute or so. All right, but we're not going to do that right now. So that's just a little homework for you. All right, so plasma proteins make up about 9% of plasma. We talked about the three types, the albumins, globulins, and fibrinogen. Albumins are important for maintaining water balance in your body so that you don't become edemic. Globulins carry lipids, but also globulins can become antibodies, right? And the antibodies are certain kinds of molecules that can bind to toxins or other kinds of antigens and deactivate them in your body. And the third thing is fibrinogen. That's an important clotting factor. So we're going to look at that process later on in this chapter. All right, but since we're talking about fibrinogen, there's some important nomenclature that you should be aware of. Whenever you see a word with a suffix ogen right here, that means that this particular molecule is an inactive molecule, and it's in the blood and is ready to become activated at a moment's notice. All right, so fibrinogen is in your blood, and it can be activated, it can be converted into fibrin very, very quickly, and that's what you're going to see prevents blood loss. All right, so if it took a long time to make fibrin de novo through protein synthesis, by the time your body made enough fibrin, maybe you would have bled to death already, right? So fibrin is in a reserve form in your blood called fibrinogen, and it can be activated very, very quickly. Okay, formed elements, erythrocytes, all right, red blood cells. The surface area is for diffusion. It's got that biconcave shape. They lack a nucleus and mitochondria because they're loaded with a chemical compound that transports oxygen, and that is hemoglobin. So these cells are loaded with hemoglobin. They don't have room for anything else inside these cells. That's how important a job they perform. They transport oxygen in our bodies because oxygen really does not like to, for physical chemistry reasons, dissolve in water. So it has to be carried by something else other than plasma. And each red blood cell contains about 280 million hemoglobin molecules. And each hemoglobin molecule can carry 4 oxygen molecules. So this is the cell that's doing the job of transporting oxygen in our cardiovascular system. And your body produces about 300 billion red blood cells each day. And why is that? Okay, because remember, these red blood cells only live for about 120 days. And so that's about as how many red blood cells in your body die every day. So if you don't produce the same amount that actually die, what disease condition do you have? Then you would be anemic as a result of that. Okay, so 300 billion, that's a pretty huge number. Okay, leukocytes. All right, fight infection. They do have a nucleus, mitochondria, and some have amoeboid activity. That means that they can actually change shape. These are shapeshifters, and they can squeeze through small spaces. They're found in the blood, but they can actually leave capillaries through these little fenestrations and crawl around in tissue spaces where they look for bacteria and fungi and viruses and tumor cells or other kinds of cells that invade your body. Okay, this shape-shifting activity is what we call diapedesis. All right, so diapedesis is like a walking around. Just by extruding some cytoplasm and cell membrane in one direction, these cells can actually move around inside your body. All right, granular leukocytes help detoxify foreign substances and release heparin. And heparin is an anticoagulant. All right, so heparin is important because in a normal blood vessel, you don't want a blood clot. All right, so these are the granular leukocytes. Oop, wrong button. All right, agranular leukocytes. We have lymphocytes and monocytes. These are the ones that can very easily leave the cardiovascular system. They act by the processes of phagocytosis. All right, and so that would be a monocyte. When a monocyte leaves the cardiovascular system, it becomes a macrophage or a big eater. So it can actually surround a cell or a bacteria, import it into the cytoplasm where a lysosome then fuses with a vesicle that some infectious particle is on. And then what's the job of a lysosome? If something gets inside a lysosome, what happens to whatever it is that got inside? Yeah, it's digested, right? Because a lysosome is an intracellular digestive system, and then it's destroyed. Lymphocytes, on the other hand, you've got a couple of different types, but here are lymphocytes, and you can see they're almost made up of the nucleus, right? Lymphocytes are B lymphocytes that make antibodies against foreign substances that don't belong in your body. Maybe it could be a transplanted organ, or it could be a virus or whatever, an infectious particle like that. And when an antibody binds to one of those cells, then it destroys the cell membrane of that cell, and of course a cell can't be alive when its cell membrane is destroyed. Other kinds of lymphocytes are what we call T lymphocytes. These are contact killers, so the T lymphocytes actually have to bump into the cell that they are attacking, and when it bumps into the cell, it secretes substances that destroys the cell membrane of those cells that don't belong in your body, and again, they die as a result. So lymphocytes can produce antibodies or be contact killers. Platelets, another name for a platelet is thrombocyte. They're the smallest of the formed elements, right? And they can move by amoeboid action as well. They come from cells that we call megakaryocytes. And a megakaryocyte just sloughs off little fragments of cytoplasm with plasma membrane around them. And that happens in bone marrow, right? And as a matter of fact, platelets make most of the mass of a blood clot. So they're important for preventing blood loss. A platelet can release serotonin, and the job of serotonin is vasoconstriction. What happens to flow through a tube when it constricts? Does it increase or decrease? It decreases. And by how much? Do you have a sense? A lot, right? Small change in the radius of the blood vessel means a big change in flow through that area. So serotonin causes vasoconstriction, which can drastically reduce blood flow through a damaged blood vessel, which means that helps prevent blood loss, okay, just by that vasoconstriction. Platelets also secrete growth factors to maintain the integrity of blood vessels so that they don't become leaky. And platelets, again, only live for about 5 to 9 days, right? Not very long. So those are produced rapidly in your body. I don't have a figure to know exactly how many are made, okay? But in terms of making red blood cells, we call that hematopoiesis. I have a sneeze. It went away. Ah, good. Okay, hematopoiesis. That's the formation of blood cells, and hematopoiesis is the formation of erythrocytes. It's also the formation of leukocytes and thrombocytes as well. And they come from stem cells in bone marrow. So bone marrow is what we call a myeloid tissue. That's the tissue that makes red blood cells and white blood cells and platelets. So marrow produces about 500 billion blood cells every day. And in the fetus, it's not in the myeloid tissue is not red bone marrow, okay, but it occurs in the liver. Oh, and as a matter of fact, you might want to write down on this slide over here what kind of bone marrow. And I think probably you should know that from anatomy. How many different kinds of bone marrow are there? Yeah, there's two kinds. There's red and white. And red and yellow. Did you say yellow? Well, what did you say? Red and? There's red bone marrow, which is the myeloid tissue that makes red blood cells, okay, and yellow bone marrow, which is just a storage form for fat, okay. And depending on the kind of fat, it could look a little white as well. Okay. Erythropoiesis is just a little specialization of hematopoiesis. It means what? The production or the formation of red blood cells in particular. And leukopoiesis in particular is a formation of white blood cells. And people can get into clinical problems in either one of these cases right here. Erythropoiesis is stimulated by a hormone called erythropoietin. And erythropoietin is produced by the kidney. So when there is decreased oxygen concentration in the blood, that's monitored by the kidney releases erythropoietin, which goes to bone marrow, and it stimulates proliferation of those stem cells into red blood cells. And in the hospital, I have no clue. I can just go back. As long as I don't save it, huh? Undo button. Okay, where do I go from here? Oh, that's a nice little button. Okay. Now stop clicking. All right, so EPO is what you hear in a hospital. It used to be that we got erythropoietin from animal sources, right? And then you'd have to grind up a bunch of kidneys and then filter it to get rid of the tissue and then isolate erythropoietin, which is really expensive. Plus, I don't know, how many kidneys does an organism usually have, like a horse or a pig? Only two, and they're small, right? So you have to grind up a lot of kidneys to get erythropoietin. But EPO is a genetically engineered form of human erythropoietin. So that's kind of interesting because the human gene for erythropoietin was transferred to a bacterium. And now this bacteria, sitting in a test tube all day long, is making erythropoietin and secreting it into the fluid, and it's very easy to harvest. So EPO is now relatively cheap as a result of that genetic engineering. Okay, but it's the exact same erythropoietin that people make, which has some benefits, as opposed to some other nonspecific erythropoietin. Leukapheresis is a formation of white blood cells stimulated by a variety of signaling compounds that we call cytokines. And these are regulators that are secreted by the immune system. And we're just going to leave it like that. But control of the immune system is pretty complex. And we just don't have time to go over that in this class. But I bet in micro you go over that a little bit. Okay, so erythropoiesis. You lose about 2.5 million red blood cells every second. So guess how many red blood cells do you have to make every second? 2.5 million, right? Otherwise, you become anemic. Lifespan is only about 120 days. Old red blood cells are removed from the blood by phagocytic cells in the liver and spleen and bone marrow. All right, so I want to write on the board. I never made a slide of this. All right, so here we have a nice red blood cell, and it's loaded with hemoglobin. Oh, come on. I thought this marker was going to work. Oh, wrong one. I grabbed one earlier. Where did it go? Did I put it down over here someplace? Right here? Is that the one you were thinking of? I had a nice black one someplace. Okay. All right, so here you have a nice red blood cell, more or less. All right, and then we got hemoglobin. And hemoglobin is part protein, and it's also part other kinds of organic compounds. Plus, there's an iron molecule in hemoglobin. So when this red blood cell dies, right, all the proteins then can be recycled. What does a protein turn into when it's being recycled? It's broken down into amino acids, right, and then those various amino acids can be reincorporated into a protein. So hemoglobin in these tissues that we just talked about is broken down into heme and to globin, right? And globin then is broken down into amino acids, which then can be used to make any other kind of protein that your body needs. Heme, on the other hand, is broken down into Fe, which is what? Iron, all right? And then bilirubin, or actually the first compound is called biliverdin. All right, and biliverdin is excreted from your body. This is heme is a very complicated organic kind of compound, and it is not recycled. But this iron is recycled because it can be used to make more hemoglobin. And all of these amino acids can be recycled to make more hemoglobin as well. But the biliverdin or bilirubin, right, these are pigments. Biliverdin is kind of a green color, bilirubin, kind of an interesting name, is actually a yellow compound, and that's excreted from your body. So iron recycled back into hemoglobin. All right, so here is probably an exam figure that shows erythropoiesis, or more importantly, the control of erythropoiesis. You have the stimulus, which is low blood oxygen, and the kidney then monitors oxygen concentration, When oxygen concentration is low, it's going to secrete erythropoietin. That's a hormone. Where does that go? Where does a hormone go? Into the blood. And then once it's in the blood, it goes everywhere, right? And including red bone marrow. And red bone marrow has receptors for erythropoietin. And that stimulates red bone marrow to increase the number of red blood cells that it's producing. Right, and as you increase the number of red blood cells, what happens to the oxygen carrying capacity of blood? It increases, right? And how does that relate to the initial stimulus right here? All right, so maybe, okay, this arrow right here, I'd actually like to have maybe up higher in this diagram just a little bit. It's not, but can you at least see that the response subtracts from the initial stimulus? So that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so just remember that's EPO secreted by the kidney and to some degree the liver as well. Okay, blood groups. These are things that we find on the surface of red blood cells, okay, and it can cause problems. It produces blood type, and this is something different than blood clots, but it's going to look something similar. So think of this red blood cell right here. So I'm going to erase this little diagram that we got. So there are two components that I want you to think about in terms of blood groups. All right, so here we have a nice red blood cell. On the surface of red blood cells, there are antigens. These are markers that tell your body that these cells belong to your body and they're not from the outside world, okay? And we're going to be looking at the ABO system. So one of these, okay, antigens that was discovered first just was given the name A because it was the first one that was discovered, all right? And it doesn't really look like an A, but I'm going to draw it on the board as an A just so that you can follow the discussion. All right, so this is the A antigen. So where are antigens located? Right on the cell membrane of cells. And in particular, we're talking about red blood cells. There is another component in blood, right? We said that the fluid part of blood contains antibodies. And this is what an antibody looks like. It almost looks like a little man right here. And it's got a couple receptor sites that look like hands. And then these receptor sites, right, are built so that they can interact with antigens. And how is a receptor site, an active site, going to interact with an antigen? By just the shape, right? Just complementary shape. So what is the shape of this active site right here? Let's make it look just like that. Okay, so this is going to allow this molecule to bind to that antigen right there. All right, so this is what we call an antibody, but in particular, this is what? An A antibody. And an A antibody. And where are these found? These are in the, all right, so this is on the cell surface. Antigens are on the cell surface. Antibodies are in plasma. And fortunately, this is not really complicated to appreciate because if somebody has blood type A, they have the A antigen on the surface of their red blood cells. That's all that means. Okay. And also, somebody that has blood type A cannot be making anti-A antibodies because what would happen? Because then the person's own antibodies will attack these cells right here. Okay, that would be an autoimmune disease. And maybe it does happen in some individuals. Okay, but that's the basis of autoimmune disease. All right, so what other kind of blood types are there in the ABO system? So they started experimenting with more and more blood. They found another antigen on the cell surface. And guess what? They found another one. And they didn't want to call this A prime or A zero or whatever, so they call it B. All right, so this is blood type. This is blood type A. What blood type is this right here? B. Blood type B. Okay, and then, all right, they actually found another interesting red blood cell that has both A and B antigens on the surface of these cells. Okay, so what blood type is this one right here? Yeah, so this is blood type AB. Okay, and then they're looking around some more and some more and some more, and they found a fourth type. So there are four types according to the ABO system, and this cell looks like this. And what is it missing? It has no antigens on the plasma membrane. So what are you going to call that thing? Somebody's going to say zero. Could we have A and B and AB and zero? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So everybody was sitting around the table thinking what to do, and somebody said, oh, I have an idea. Okay, we're going to call this blood type O because O kind of looks like a zero. Okay, and zero means no antigens on the cell surface of these cells right here. All right, so this is going to be blood type O. No antigens. Blood type O, which you should think of as zero. Okay. All right, so that's part of the story. What's another part of the story? The other part of the story is that a person with blood type A right here is automatically making anti-B antibodies. All right, so this person is going to have anti-B antibodies. Somebody with blood type B will have what kind of antibodies? Anti-A. Okay. And this person right here is going to have anti what? Can't have any, right? Because it will interact with these cells, so no antibodies. All right, so no antibodies. And blood type O is going to have both anti-A and anti-B, okay, to protect the body. All right, so both anti-A and B. And you don't have to be pre-sensitized. Your body, I don't know when it develops, but early on in life, your body just starts producing these antibodies to protect your circulatory system. All right, so this can produce transfusion reactions. So what do you want to make sure you realize? That antigens are on the cell surface, antibodies are in the plasma, right? So don't forget about those, where they're located. And this will determine what kind of blood, okay, you can receive in a transfusion. All right, so people with blood type A make antibodies to blood type B because they make anti-B, all right, but not to type A. Blood type B has antibodies to type A, but not to B. All right, so we just kind of talked about this. All right, so different mixture of blood types can cause a transfusion reaction, which is agglutination. All right, so let's take a look and see what agglutination is. How about if we have somebody with blood type A getting a transfusion from somebody that's blood type B? What kind of antibody does blood type B have? It's got anti-A. All right, so if they get a transfusion with blood type B, all right, it's loaded with these antibodies, right, that can bind one cell with one arm, then it can bind another red blood cell over here with another one, and here's another antigen, and here's another antibody. And what can it bind to? It can bind to another cell. So now you have all these cells all linked together by these antibodies, and as a result, these cell membranes are going to be destroyed, and that will lyse all of the cells when that happens. Okay, so if that were to happen, that certainly would be a deadly process. That process is what we call agglutination. So I want you to write down what the definition of agglutination is at a molecular level. What's the interaction that is taking place when something is agglutinating? Okay, it's what kind of reaction? I kind of erased it already. It's an antibody. And what's this thing here called? Antigen. All right, so agglutination is an antigen-antibody reaction. All right, antigen-antibody reaction. And I don't want you to get that confused with coagulation, which we're going to talk about next. All right, so it's part of your immune system that's causing this problem in blood. Okay, so type O is a universal donor because it lacks A and B antigens, right? They can donate blood to anybody, right? Because the recipient's antibodies won't agglutinate a donor's type O red blood cells. And AB is what we call a universal recipient because it doesn't make anti-A or anti-B antigens and won't agglutinate the donor's red blood cells. And here is just a photograph of what agglutination looks like under different circumstances. And you can just see the clumping of red blood cells and then eventually the destruction of these red blood cells. I don't know if you do this in lab anymore or not. Okay, but a transfusion reaction is what kind of reaction between what two kinds of molecules? Antigen and antibody. It's an antigen-antibody reaction, part of your immune system. Okay, let's talk about Rh factor. So people became really interested in looking at antigens on the surface of cells, and they discovered another one. And they were looking at red blood cells from a rhesus monkey, and it just turned out that humans have the same antigen as well on their on the plasma membranes of their red blood cells. And there is, for the Rh antigen, all right, if you have this antigen, and I'll just make it Rh like that, this is going to be positive. And if you have red blood cells without any antigen on them like that, that's going to be negative. Okay. And normally in people, you don't automatically make anti-Rh factors or antibodies. But you can, for instance, if somebody is... Can somebody that's Rh negative have anti-Rh produced in their body? Is that a problem? If you have anti-Rh, this is the antibody, it won't affect these cells right here because there are no antigens on the cell surface. Okay, so maybe most of us are like this if we're blood type negative, Rh negative. Okay, but if this person gets a transfusion with Rh positive blood, right, then there won't be any deleterious effects. But if they get a second transfusion, then there can be agglutination taking place. Because after the first transfusion will stimulate the production of anti-Rh antibodies in the blood. So the second transfusion then becomes highly problematic. And where this plays an important role is, for instance, when somebody's having a baby, okay, and let me see if I can get this right without looking at the slide. If the mom, okay, so if the mom is Rh negative and the dad, right, is Rh positive. And this is why way back when you had to get blood tests before you got married, at least in the United States, to see if there was this particular combination. Because when mom and dad have a kid, there's a 50% chance it will be Rh negative and a 50% chance that the kid will be Rh positive. Okay. So the first child, there's no interaction with the mom. Let's say that the child has Rh positive blood in them. Okay, so the baby has Rh positive blood. For the first pregnancy, this blood really doesn't intermix until parturition. Right, when the placenta separates from the uterus and there's mixing of fetal and maternal blood, at that particular time, then the mom gets sensitized to Rh-positive blood and then starts to make anti-Rh. So on the second pregnancy, right, mom has anti-Rh, and if the second child is Rh-positive, then the mom's antibodies can start to destroy the red blood cells in the fetus. All right, so there's a lot of hemoglobin is produced, and the fetus then has to break all that hemoglobin down. What's the product of the breakdown of hemoglobin that's colored? Bilirubin, biliverdin, okay? And so that's why sometimes babies are born jaundiced when they have that yellow color, because there was an antibody antigen reaction taking place during gestation. Okay, that can be prevented by using something called Rogam, but that is something that then protects the fetus right here. All right, so Let me draw some cells on the board. You can tell me what blood type they are. Oh, I tell you what. This condition right here is called hemolytic disease of the newborn, or sometimes it's called erythroblastosis fetalis. And bilirubin and biliverdin are fairly toxic to developing nervous systems. So it's good to have that diagnosed very early on, okay, in pregnancy. Okay, and not let it linger on. Okay, hemostasis is the next topic. But tell me what blood type we're looking at right here. What's the blood type of this person? AB, but I would like it in terms of the ABO system as well as the RH factor system. This is what? Yeah, but what about the ABO system? So it is completely what? AB negative, right? AB negative, because there's no RH factor right here. All right, what would be the blood type of this person right here? O positive, right? You see how that works? Just the blood type that a person has is determined by the antigens that are on the cell surface, okay? It's just really as simple as that. Now, what about this blood type? O negative. All right, so I'm not going to draw all the blood types out there, but I think you get a feel for how that works. Okay, anybody have any questions on blood typing? Now, if you are in a car accident and you have a lot of hemorrhage and you run into the emergency room and say, I need a transfusion right away because I lost a lot of blood and I know what blood type I am, okay, are they going to believe you? Absolutely not. They still have to do a cross match because what we learned about are just two systems. And somebody's going to run a whole panel of antigen-antibody reactions on you to get you the best matched blood that's possible. Okay, so today nobody's going to get, if you're a universal recipient, you're not going to get blood from just about anybody. It's going to be cross-matched with a whole number of different kinds of systems. All right, so it doesn't produce any kind of transfusion reactions. Okay, hemostasis, that's a cessation of bleeding when a blood vessel is damaged, and we've got two kinds, two main processes. We've got platelet plug formation and fibrin formation. Can anybody remember where fibrin comes from? Fibrinogen, yeah, is the inactive precursor. Okay, and platelets come from those megakaryocytes, right? Those are just thrombocytes in your body, and platelet plug formation is good for small kinds of tears, almost microscopic tears in a blood vessel, but for macroscopic tears, then you need to have fibrin formation augmenting platelet plug formation to stop that bleeding. All right, so let's take a look at the next slide. All right, so here we have a blood vessel. Here's the lumen of a blood vessel. Here's the endothelium of a blood vessel. And then here's some underlying connective tissue. And these filaments right here are collagen, right? So collagen, you should be aware of, that's an important strength kind of fiber in connective tissue. And there are some molecules called von Willebrand factors, right, attached to this collagen. And if blood is in contact with collagen and these von Willebrand factors right here, a platelet plug will form. But under this condition right here, right, when there's no injury to a blood vessel, can a platelet get in contact with this collagen? It's separated by the endothelium, right? So the endothelium prevents platelet plug formation from occurring. These endothelial cells also release nitric oxide and prostacyclin, which is PGI2, which then keeps clots from forming, and these are also vasodilators, right? So that keeps blood moving over the surface, but if there's no leak in the blood vessel, right, then that's fine. There's something else. There, on the surface of these endothelial cells, there's an enzyme called CD39, and CD39 is breaking down ADP, right, which is produced by cells into AMP, and ADP is an important activator of platelets. And if ADP concentration is maintained low, then the platelets won't become activated. So this slide shows what happens under the best of circumstances when you don't have a damaged blood vessel. All right, next slide, we'll show what happens when you damage a blood vessel. Right, you disrupt the endothelium, and now platelets can come in contact with collagen and these von Willebrand factors. The von Willebrand factors increases the affinity of platelets with collagen, and these platelets, when they bind to collagen, start to release some chemicals like ADP and serotonin and TAXA A2, which is thromboxane A2. And I don't want that to go away. So serotonin is a vasoconstrictor, okay? And so that prevents blood loss, so this blood vessel is going to start to constrict, right? And ADP activates other platelets, so these kind of look like red blood cells, but think of them really as platelets, but they're so small, I guess they just drew them in as like a red blood cell right here, right? But these are really platelets. All right, so they're drawn, because they can move by diapedesis, they're drawn to the site of the injury, and an active platelet is sticky. So these platelets are going to get glued together, and they're going to release more TAXA A2 and more ADP and more serotonin. So these platelets will just aggregate in this region of the damage to this blood vessel. All right, and TAXA A2 is a prostaglandin, and you know that you can use aspirin as an anticoagulant. It reduces platelet plug formation because aspirin, one of the side effects of aspirin, is that it's an inhibitor of prostaglandin synthesis. All right, so it blocks, aspirin blocks platelet plug formation. So if somebody's on a regimen of aspirin and it's too high, what would be one of the side effects of being on aspirin that's too high a dose? Yeah, you're going to have bleeding in various places of your body, right? You're going to be much more prone to bleeding under normal circumstances. Yeah, you know, it's really strange. I asked how somebody ever came up with that 81 milligrams a day, which is an adult aspirin dose when you're trying to reduce clotting function. And nobody really knows how that came about. But that seems to be an effective dose for most people, if you can tolerate it. An effective dose to reduce clotting function, but not produce bleeding, excessive bleeding. Okay. But however, now if you get into an accident, like a bicycle accident or a car accident, you will have reduced clotting function. Or maybe you go to see a dentist, for instance, and have a tooth drilled, you will have excessive bleeding as a result. But under normal circumstances, that's a pretty effective dose. To where if you go up to, if you double it, if you take two aspirins a day, then you'll notice that you're just bleeding way too much. Like if you scratch yourself or something, if you have an itch, then you'll start bleeding in that area, okay? So it's just a generally accepted dose that works well for most people. But you still can experience gastric problems. It could still upset your stomach. So some people just can't tolerate aspirin from that standpoint. Okay, so this is the first one. All right, platelet plug formation, and it's good for what? Microscopic tears in a blood vessel, not for macroscopic tears. All right, so for macroscopic tears, well, this kind of just recapitulates everything that we talked about. So here we have that microscopic tear, and it's been sealed over by a platelet plug controlled by these various compounds that we talked about. Okay, but now the role of fibrin. If there's a tear to a blood vessel that's way too big for a platelet plug to seal over, then fibrin is going to come to the rescue. All right, and this process is what we call coagulation. So coagulation is different than agglutination. What did we say about agglutination? What kind of what's the molecular basis for agglutination? What kind of reaction is it? Antigen-antibody reaction, okay? But coagulation is fibrin formation, right, which is different. It has nothing to do with antigens and antibodies. It just has to do with the conversion of fibrinogen into fibrin. Okay, so let's take a look and see, what does that look like? Oh, I didn't reorder. I didn't save it. Okay, so fibrin, all right, fibrinogen is a soluble protein. Okay. Fibrinogen is a soluble protein that dissolves in plasma, but fibrin is an insoluble protein. It precipitates out of solution, and when it precipitates out, it makes this network or a mesh that red blood cells and plasma and thrombocytes try to squeeze through, but they can't because the mesh is too narrow. All right, so fibrin forms this mesh over a damaged blood vessel that prevents blood loss. All right, so coagulation is what kind of formation would you put right here? Fibrin formation. All right, so let's go back up to right here. So coagulation can occur by two different pathways. Right, there's an intrinsic pathway and an extrinsic pathway. Intrinsic pathway is how blood clots in damaged blood vessels and also when blood is left in a test tube. Okay, and it's initiated by the exposure of blood to negatively charged surfaces in a blood vessel because these proteins like collagen have negative charges and glass has a negative charge on it. This activates a protease, which initiates a series of clotting factors. Some things are necessary for fibrin formation to take place, namely calcium has to be present, right? And there has to be phospholipids in order to convert an enzyme called prothrombin into thrombin. All right, so what did we learn about fibrinogen and fibrin? What about fibrinogen? What can you tell me about fibrinogen? It's inactive, right? It's in a proper concentration in your body, and it can become activated at a very nice level very quickly. Okay, here is something else that's similar to that. If you ever see a word, check this out. If you ever see a word, okay, like protein, okay, it doesn't count. But if you see some words like prothrombin, it has the same meaning. You've heard of prohormones. These are the precursors to active hormones. So prothrombin is the inactive form of thrombin, and your body is producing a lot of prothrombin, so this is the reserve form of thrombin, and it can be activated very quickly if you need to build a blood clot. And is that a good idea? If you cut yourself and you're bleeding, okay, is it okay for you to wait around a couple of days before it stops, or would you like for it to stop as soon as possible? Soon as possible, right? So it's nice to have a reserve of thrombin, okay, in the form of prothrombin that can be activated very quickly, okay. And thrombin is an enzyme that converts fibrinogen to fibrin, right, which makes that meshwork that forms over a damaged blood vessel. All right, so that's the intrinsic pathway. We're going to talk about this some more, okay, on the next couple slides. Extrinsic pathway activates when damage to tissue outside blood vessel releases tissue thromboplastin that triggers a shortcut in the coagulation process. Thromboplastin is always fully active, never needs activation. It just needs exposure to act. It needs exposure to collagen fibers in order to become activated. All right, so let's look at this diagram right here. Okay, and I think in the study guide I have this diagram without some of these other little notes that I made on this slide. So if you want to know how to label your exam figure, okay, then just look at this PowerPoint slide. Because I put this little arrow in right here, and then I put this little cheat sheet in for you. So coagulation, okay, what the heck is coagulation again? Is it an antibody-antigen reaction? No, it's not. That is agglutination. It's fibrin formation. Yeah, fibrin formation. So here you see the bottom line, fibrin formation. And fibrin formation comes from the activation or the conversion of fibrinogen into fibrin. All right, the three steps. We're going to go back maybe the way we were going here in a second, but I want to tell you about these three steps. The first step is prothrombin activator formation. The second step is thrombin formation. And then the third step and last step is fibrin formation. All right, so here we have fibrinogen, which is ready to go to work, but it's got to be converted into fibrin. It's converted into fibrin by an enzyme, and that enzyme is called thrombin. And what can you tell me about enzymatic reactions? What happens to the enzyme during an enzymatically catalyzed reaction? Does it get used up?
No.
So this one thrombin molecule right here can convert thousands of fibrinogen molecules into fibrin. All right, so what do we call that when you have an enzyme that works and works and works, doesn't get degraded, and produces a helpful product in your body? That's what we call amplification. Okay? And that's basically the scheme that we're looking at right here, is that here is a sequence of enzymatic reactions, which is just a series of steps of amplification, right? And if you have a series of steps of amplifications, then there's one word that describes that. And then we'll think about why it's in your body like that. Okay, if you have a series of enzymatic reactions, all with a level of amplification, we call that a cascade mechanism. So what's the beauty of a cascade mechanism? You can have a small stimulus, and it's going to produce what kind of response? A big response and a fast response, right? So let's look at some of these cascade mechanisms. And also, okay, I see something over here that has a positive sign on it. This is some feedback. So here's a feedback loop, right? But what kind of feedback loop is this? And we're going to analyze this in just a second. Is that positive or negative feedback? Okay. This is where thrombin not only converts fibrinogen to fibrin, which is the end product, but thrombin also activates some other clotting factors that produces more thrombin. And as more thrombin is produced, it activates this intrinsic pathway to produce more thrombin, which activates more clotting factors, right, to produce more thrombin. All right, so in this particular case, this positive feedback mechanism is important because it speeds up the formation of fibrin and also the magnitude of fibrin formation. So that if this step right here does not take place, then an individual cannot make sufficient amount of fibrin to prevent blood loss. And this is the step that's blocked by heparin. And what do you know about heparin? What kind of class of drug is heparin? It's an anti-what? Anticoagulant, because it disrupts this nice positive feedback mechanism of the intrinsic pathway. All right, so that's pretty cool that you see that. All right, so fibrin formation is produced by active thrombin. Thrombin formation, right, we said, well, there's prothrombin right here, is activated by prothrombin activator, which is factor 10. Prothrombin activator is another enzyme, so here's another level of amplification. Prothrombin activator doesn't get used up during the reaction. Right, and now here you see some other things. In order to have proper clotting function, I just looked at the clock, you need some other things in blood besides these enzymes. What do you need? Calcium and phospholipids. I see calcium and phospholipids. So you need to have proper calcium balance inside your body to have proper coagulation function. All right, so that's another important function for calcium, is to prevent blood loss. All right, so now you know what, for synaptic transmission, you need proper calcium. For muscle contraction, you need proper calcium levels. For coagulation, you need proper calcium levels. All right, and the last place probably where you really need it is in bones, and that's the decision your body makes all the time as we grow older and don't exercise and have proper vitamin D and calcium in our diet. Okay? All right, so we're going to finish up with this diagram next time and then finish blood too next time.